Welcome to the Three True Outcomes Scoresheet Baseball Podcast, presented by Baseball Prospectus. I'm your host and owner and operator of Pop's Taco Shop, Ian Lefkowitz. And joining me, as always, from Michigan, he's still deciding between Betty and Veronica's, Ben Murphy. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Ian. How are you?
I'm doing well, too. Very much looking forward to today's episode, filled with mirth and merriment.
And mystery, much like the town
of Riverdale. And joining me, from our nation's capital, he keeps telling me the town is a character. It's Jared Weitz.
Riverdale's so good.
Yeah, that does seem like your kind of show.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means it's your kind of show.
Wait, I don't know what this is, but is it aimed at, like, high school girls?
Got in one.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with high school girls.
Oh, no, certainly not. But there probably is something wrong with the TV made for them.
No,
this is quality television.
It's really good. It's a cross between like Twin Peaks and 90210.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
There's a lot to like, and I'm sure we'll get into that. We are not here to talk about Archie Andrews and his blank stare acting. Well, we are here to talk about probably baseball.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure yet. Before we do that, one programming note. So we should talk about that whole intro thing, huh? Because we mentioned it last time. And I didn't realize, because I don't listen to the intro music. What's going on, Ben?
I don't know. I thought it would be fun to change up the music. And when I asked you guys what you wanted, you gave me some examples of music, and then I tried to find music that sounded like that and to fade it in the way you said you wanted me to.
There you go. We're trying things out. We got a Baseball Prospectus reader question about it.
Yeah. Well, if they hate it, they can blame me, and if they like it, they can credit you.
That's
you get a music supervisor credit now, I think, Ben.
Yeah. I also get, like, producer credit and technician credit and all kinds of other hogwash.
Yeah.
Ben is dishing his credit rating. That's why you're hearing the noise.
I'm eating mini sea salt caramels. They're delicious.
Oh, that does sound delicious.
Our commitment to you, the listener, remains unabated here at U4. We are happy to be back, take a quick break, but we're going to be answering some reader questions. Before we do that, please send us more questions. We'd love to get them. You can email us at scoresheet@baseballprospectus.com. We are very excited because this is obviously an important time for a lot of decisions to be made. So we've answered a couple off-air questions, and we'll answer some on-air right now. If it's about the upcoming draft, great. We love philosophical questions. Are we going to make an active pitch for more off-topic questions?
Sure.
Yeah, that way we can blame you. all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no tangents this year. We were fortunate enough to get a couple of good questions, so I'm going to turn it over to our mailbag captain now to see what's going on.
Cool. The first question comes from Matt. It's a keeper question. He's in an 18-team BL. He keeps up to 13 plus one free minor leaguer. I like this concept of free minor leaguers. He says he went... from building entirely with prospects for a few years, then he got a core, so he traded some prospects to get veterans and contended, which he did last year, but cratered in September. The problem
I hear
was
that.
Yeah. Also the other months, too, for us. But the problem was mainly pitching. So he's the keepers that he has is more definite are Odor, Aledmus, Chris Bryant, Polanco, Jock Peterson, Nomar Mazara, in the pitching front, Cole, Keuchel, Harvey. And then the ones that he has on the fringe are Reed, Domingo Santana, mm-hmm. Tyler Skaggs, and Reynaldo Lopez, along with Honeywell as his free minor leaguer. He includes some other people on his roster, I think, just to troll me, including Zach Davies and Wellington Castillo. So he's asking, what should his keepers be? What do you think about the fringe guys? Would you keep some of them, try to trade them all away, drop them? Any thoughts?
All right. Well, there's a lot going on here, and thanks for the question. I really do like the Zach Davies, Jeff Hoffman, and Wellington Castillo as the ghosts of Orioles past, present, and future.
If you want to make sure your question gets on air.
Troll Jared. Make an Orioles dig.
Or just ask us a question.
Benedito will do it for you.
Anyway, so I think I have kind of one philosophical question about this before we get to the nuts and bolts of who to keep, who not to. Do you feel like keeper questions really change that much based upon whether you're contending or not?
Yeah.
In terms of who to keep and who to trade from your team, I understand. But like when you, like if you're saying, give me a list of guys.
If you're saying, yeah, there's like 30 seconds before keepers are due, would it make a difference if you're a rebuilder or contending?
Maybe on the
Is that your question?
Yeah, and I think the answer is on the margins, but I don't really see that much of a difference, to be honest.
Yeah, I guess if it's like 11:59 and keepers are due at midnight, you're probably just keeping as much value as you possibly can, regardless of, well, like, you're keeping as much present value as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're keeping a prospect, it's only in so much as he's going to help you be good later. Just like keeping a major leaguer to help you be good now, I guess.
Yeah, so I guess the question is a soft 13, but I feel like whether a guy is a keeper is just kind of for me more of a question of whether you think he is worthy of being protected, because otherwise he would be taken higher than the pick with which you protect him.
Yeah.
And that's not going to change all that much based on whether you're contending or not.
I think if you're definitely rebuilding, you might opt to keep or gamble a little bit more on your keepers, depending on your risk aversion. Like, I would bet that if Jared had drafted some prospects, he'd probably overkeep those prospects. And, you know, hold out hope that they're going to one day be good and not pull a Byron Buxton on him.
I think that pitcher listed was Hunter Harvey for a second, which would have been a solid case in point.
I don't know. I think your point stands, though. If they're good enough to be drafted earlier than the round you would keep them, then you shouldn't keep them, right?
Yeah. Which informs my fringe picks to some degree. 18-team BL, so I think that's a little smaller than some of the BLs that we're used to, but still, I feel like it gets pretty tight. I think you have some pretty decent players at the back end, and I probably would rather the players than the pick slot, unless you're going to be a really high pick slot. To be perfectly honest. So I think I would keep all of those guys. If I had to rank them, I would rank Domingo Santana high. I think he's higher than some of the guys who you didn't list as fringe guys. Probably Tyler Skaggs next, although, as he pointed out, Tyler Skaggs has kind of been all over the place in his career. And may not be completely trustworthy. I think I would anticipate a bounce back from AJ Reed, and then have Reynaldo Lopez in fourth. I don't love Comiskey Park as a great place for pitchers, but maybe he will pick up a you know, whatever Don Cooper magic the White Sox have. And I also think Zach Davies is not too far from being a keeper. I'm with you. It's just off the list, but I think he'll have a better 2017 than a number of guys who end up being kept in a bunch of leagues. Any other thoughts?
I just knocked something over in my office. I apologize.
I like that he's had Tyler Skaggs three different times. That's impressive.
And he's willing to admit it.
Well, haven't the Angels had him a few times as well? So that's art imitating life.
Yeah, I don't know that I have any different opinions than you on this one. Ben, do you have anything?
I don't know anything about any of these guys except for that I think in my initial email to Matt, I referred him to the mock draft. I think he mentioned that Ronaldo Lopez didn't even get didn't even get drafted in the mock draft. And the mock draft goes 16 rounds and I think had 23 teams this year, 22, which is considerably deeper than his 18-team, 13-round. So I'd probably toss him back if it were me. But that's because I don't know stuff about guys, so I just use the mock draft as my barometer.
Yeah, I think that's pretty tight. I don't think Ronaldo Lopez is going to project terribly well. And I don't think the White Sox are, a really good ballpark for him. But I just have to think, the 90th percentile of Ronaldo Lopez looks pretty sweet, and some of it is actually just kind of player value. But I feel like if you let Ronaldo Lopez go, somebody would snap him up before the 13th round. Although I could be wrong. It depends on how much your league loves prospects. And you'll have a better sense of that than I do.
All right.
Cool. The next question comes from Brad, who's in a 12-team NL league. He included the mock draft rankings in his email, which is awesome. Saves us time. Thanks,
Brad. Saves me a sort.
So he's got a few questions in there. Maybe let's run through his team real quick, and then we can get through the questions. So in mock draft order, he's got Corey Seager, Miguel Cabrera, Cueto, Hamels, A.J. Pollock, Lamb, Baez, Crawford, Domingo Santana again, Ben Zobrist, Brandon Crawford. What did I say?
You said Crawford, but okay, never mind.
Brandon Crawford, not Carl Crawford.
Well, or J.P. Okay, never mind.
Brandon Crawford.
You also asked the question about J.P. Crawford later. So.
I should have clarified. I apologize. Brandon Crawford, Domingo Santana, Ben Zobrist, Jason Hayward, Tanner Roark, and Guerra. Then just below the keeper line, Dickerson, Ehrman, Archie Bradley, O, and John Jay. And I got at least half of those pronunciations right.
And you were saying Wong O, not O at Sean Che.
Yes. Say Wong O.
Of course.
Okay. So, I guess, first, does a keeper sound right? The keeper line, would you trade anything above and below it? And then, is anyone below the keeper line good enough to try to trade for around an extra keeper slot?
I think he just about has it. I like Alex Dickerson a little bit. To the point where I would consider, I'd consider keeping him. A little tricky, but I think he can hit a little bit. I think, as the lefty lefty bat, he can platoon pretty well for you. I think there's a little bit to like there. The problem is I also like Junior Guerra a little bit. And I don't see the obvious player to keep were to toss instead of him, I would consider, you know, I'd consider the issue, but I probably would end up taking Dickerson ahead of Guerra, just because I think there's maybe a little bit more, variability in terms of pitching, and, you know, I think it's likelier that Dickerson will be valuable, but it's pretty close. And I don't think any of those players, unfortunately, are people who anyone's going to be clamoring for unless you know someone who keeps a lot of relievers.
Yeah. The specific trade he mentions is offering around 16 for around 13, the keeper level. Is that something you would do?
Seems like you think that Dickerson is better than the round 16.
Yeah. I guess if you could keep both of them for round 16.
He was asking about trading for another keeper slot.
That's fair. I don't know why anyone would actually trade a round 16 for a keeper slot. That seems like just a license to lose value. But hey, you know,
because their team doesn't have a 13th keeper that's good enough, and it's a hard 13 protect.
Yeah. It still seems like I would want like 15 back into 14, but yeah, you know, whatever. Not going to push that too hard. I would probably, or trade into the slot, to be perfectly honest. Get some of that sweet Junior Guerra action on. Because you're probably not going to get him with the 16th round pick. So, you know. But I'm not advising the other team. I'm advising you, Brad. And you should you should look for that deal and pull it.
Maybe one thing, we've probably gone over this in the past, but when do you tend to adhere more slavishly to the mock, and when do you feel free to depart from it? Because we tend to advocate the mock rankings pretty heavily, I think. But there are definitely times where all of us will not go strictly by them.
Yeah, I adhere slavishly when it's our pick. When we made the pick, it's perfect. And when other people make it, we have to, you know, check that a little bit.
I think the mock draft ranking is just another data point to consider. And there's good examples of other places you can get data points. I think we're going to talk today a little bit about the SSM and the draft aid. And that's another example of a data point. This year especially, I felt like the mock draft was very well done by all of the mock draft owners. And I think that made me feel pretty good about the results and their applicability to keeper decisions like these. So I think as far as the mock draft is a measurement of the wisdom of the crowd, I think it's pretty useful this year especially.
Yeah, and the one standard thing applies, which is that you know, every player's in range, but for every player you can consider that more of like 22 people or 24 people decided that this player was no higher than this position.
Right.
Except in the first round.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's probably better as that measure than, like, a rank order, because, you know, I wouldn't agree with every position that a player was taken.
And it's not the average draft position either.
Right, exactly. Cool. Because that is something that will be lost to the sands of time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Brad has one final question that I think relates to something we were grappling with in our own league. He has three major league shortstops, the aforementioned Brandon Crawford, Corey Seager, and Javier Baez. And he also has J.P. Crawford. He's been trying to trade Brandon Crawford without generating much interest, who he says is injury insurance for Corey Seager and a defensive replacement, but little other value. How low would you sell Brandon Crawford in this situation, given that for his team in particular, Brandon Crawford isn't providing much value, or relatively less value than perhaps on a different team?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I had emailed him, I think, basically just asking what he had tried. And he had said that, you know, he had advertised that Crawford was available to his league and hadn't really gotten offers that he liked. I think you know, we, like you mentioned, Jared, we were sort of grappling with this. We have a team that's got a bunch of shortstops on it, and it's sort of like, especially in an NL league, there's like really only one or two places you can put them and feel like you're not just losing a ton of value. I think if I were him, maybe you could try to bundle Crawford with one of the crossovers, especially to a team that's trying to win now, because I think both of his crossovers are win now kind of players, Miguel Cabrera and Cole Hamels. I guess you could be pretty aggressive and proactive about making a lot of offers to other owners. Maybe if you initiate trade talks, they'll be a little bit more interested and engaged in trying to find a fit rather than just sort of a blanket solicitation. And I think I think Brad had mentioned that he had reached out with some direct offers to some other owners, which is good. And maybe you just have to keep that up until you get something. I guess I don't know how to answer the question about how low I'd be willing to sell on Brandon Crawford. You know, he went 119th in the mock draft. Excuse me. And, you know, I guess if that's a barometer for his value, then I probably wouldn't trade for somebody that went 100 picks later. That's like, well, Tanner Roark's on his team went almost exactly 100 picks later. I think you can do better than that if you hold on to him and wait for something to happen to your team, wait for something to happen to somebody else's team, wait for some opportunistic moment to sort of exploit the leverage that it provides you.
Yeah, I agree. It depends on how much you intend to contend as well. This looks like a contending team,
yeah,
which makes it maybe a little more incumbent that exactly. I would say one thing that might work is just trying again after the protections. As you said, with Miguel Cabrera and Cole Hamill, you know, the circumstances change for a few teams after protection. And then trying again during the draft. You may end up having to move him for picks. But I kind of like having Brandon Crawford around. Actually, we had Brandon Crawford and Corey Seager. We've had that exact combo, I think, last year in the Joe Sheehan League. And ended up playing Corey Seager and left. I didn't really regret that too much. Turns out Corey Seager can hit like a left fielder. I like Brandon Crawford. I think he is super underrated in NL leagues generally, especially among people who are not, who don't understand how strong his defense is in this format. I'm not sure he's the one you should move. I consider Javier Baez, for instance. And, you know, I don't think you should move Corey Seager. I'll stand behind that. But I think you could play Corey Seager off position in the outfield. You can play Brandon Crawford, get that giant defensive bonus, and probably not feel too bad about it.
Yeah, make up for putting Seager in the outfield.
Yeah.
Where somehow, a capable shortstop is not an above-average left fielder.
Yes. Well, yep. we fought that battle one too many times, I think. But yeah, I don't think it's impossible to play with this situation or to go into the season with the situation you have. But I would probably still consider try again aggressively moving Crawford after keepers, maybe even during the draft as people's options dwindle. Monitor who isn't getting a shortstop, and beyond that, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to have him around because I think he does a lot of good things for a team.
Makes sense. And the last thing I want to bring up is not every email. It comes from the Scoresheet Talk email group. It's a Yahoo group. So like Ian says, you can Google it. I won't say the name because I didn't ask permission to talk on air, but you can see it. I thought it was an interesting thought experiment. This person's playing in a private league. So there are some different rules involved. But last year, he traded away all his protected spots, so he's only going to have prospects to start the season. That said, he has 27 prospects that he'll be keeping. He also mentions that he somehow still has 46 draft picks plus 30 supplemental picks after that. So it's 27 prospects plus 76 picks over the course of the season, which is crazy. But, I mean, you know, good job trading away your team, I guess, for picks and prospects.
It's twice.
So he says it's a 3 or 4 year rebuild for sure. And I guess I'm kind of curious what you guys think about this sort of approach. I mean, it's definitely dynamite the team, start all over again. It's kind of fun. We've talked about this in some leagues at some point, maybe not this drastic.
Yeah, we're also talking about doing that in soft protect leagues where you can redraft some mm-hmm. major league talent.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't need to get into his list of prospects specifically, although I think it would matter probably a little bit which prospects he ended up with. But
He's got some good ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a few years ago, if one of them was like Trout, then sure, I think it could work fine. But so, yeah, would you want to do this? Would it be fun? Do you think it can work? How would you say 3 to 4 years is reasonable?
I think it's a bold strategy. Let's see if it pays off for him.
Yeah, I think 3 to 4 years is reasonable. I think one of the things that's important to remember when you're going through a rebuild like this is, especially in his case, he's already basically full up on prospects. I mean, he could draft a few, but he really wants to draft things that he can trade this year to get better players or better picks next year. So he probably wants to look for like amazing relievers way earlier than most teams would look for amazing relievers, or you know, guys that are going to be really useful as platoon partners down the road, and I guess maybe even look to trade some of the picks this year for picks next year, the year after that, and kick the bucket down the road a little bit until some of the prospects are matriculating and are ready to help him win. Because having 27 prospects and then another 76 draft picks is a little bit wasteful. Like, I mean, it's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing. But, you know, that's definitely past the upper limit of the value that you can get out of the draft. So,
yeah. And I don't, I mean, obviously, you know, I don't want to make fun of this too much because it was asked in earnest. And, you know, I think you should have fun with your fake team however you want. But this struck me a little bit as like building a house made entirely of toothpicks and then going, look at my toothpick house. I was like, okay, great. You know, it's wonderful and it shows you put a lot of thought and effort into it. But like, why? What was the purpose?
I wonder what he inherited or like what the team looked like before he did this.
So this is the process, I guess, in baseball. I don't think I get this. And, you know, obviously I say this as a fan of prospects in the minor leagues and draft picks and all those things. I also think it probably behooves yourself to have players who you keep. And I don't understand how this works going into next year, for instance. Yeah, are you going to have to trade all of your players for 27 keeper slots again?
That's part of what I was getting at, too. Is like, if you've got 27 prospects now, and most of them remain prospects, I mean, some of them will graduate, but if, you know, for all the ones that remain prospects, you either have to cut them or keep them again, and then you have no draft picks next year, so.
Yeah, but, I mean, you sort of spreading out your risk a little bit in that it's unlikely all 27 are going to be keepable next year. You get rid of the 10 or 5 that are
sure.
Turned crappy.
Sure, but...
I mean, I see your point, yes.
Yeah. You want to trade some picks this year for picks next year. Like, give somebody friggin' 8 picks this year for, like, their top pick next year or something like that. I'll give you rounds 25 through 35 in exchange for your first 2 picks next year or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how you actually get good players, probably.
Right. And even that, like the 46 draft picks left, which is great, and the 30 supplemental picks, which is great, but that's going to turn into 13 players, and they're not going to be 13 good players.
Yeah, all the good players are kept on somebody else's team. So.
Yeah. This doesn't strike me as a strategy. This strikes me as a strategy where in 3 or 4 years we're going to have to rebuild again, to be perfectly blunt.
Maybe he could trade for better prospects.
Yeah, I guess. And that's also where I'm kind of falling down. Like, I know we don't want to read the list, but there are a few prospects where, obviously he has 27 prospects. Many of them are really good. Some of them, I look at them and I go, are you sure you could not just draft that dude in the 27th round if you want?
Well, I mean, since he's keeping 27 of them, it would be a much earlier round than that, right?
Yeah, but like eighth round. No, but I mean, let's say, is the round 27 pick worth more than Michael Geddes? I feel confident that it is. Like, there's a 5% chance that Michael Geddes is a good player. He looks like a baseball player, but he can't hit. Like, maybe he'll learn to hit. That's fine. Stranger things have happened. I think if you can't draft him in the 27th round to find out, that would be weird. And if you have the 27th round pick, maybe you can draft someone even better. A player you like.
He's got 46 draft picks, so he's going to be able to draft everybody he likes.
He's got a chance. Yeah. Well, he could have 47 draft picks and not waste it on these guys. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like
consolidation, so, I think, is our advice. Consolidation.
Yeah. See what you can do. Trade 15 draft picks for a keeper who you like.
Anything.
Trade 15 of these prospects after the draft for a keeper who you like. Just go to town and just, like, get a couple of cornerstones that you can build around, and I think that's the better way to kickstart your rebuild.
Well, Ian, if I didn't know anything about prospects, how would I figure out who the really good prospects are?
Listen to the 3-3 Outcome Score Sheet Baseball Podcast.
That's where I'm at. Scoresheet at baseballperspectus.com.
Did you want me to segue to something? Yeah. Is that did I read your plans?
I don't
think you had that on the agenda.
There is no agenda. That's the whole point. Yeah. But I told you. Okay.
Joke's on you.
Yeah. Okay. So this week, Baseball Prospectus released a prospect list, top 101 prospects of 2017. I was sort of skimming through it because we actually made a trade in one of our leagues this week where we traded away Austin Meadows and some other stuff. The trade was fun, but I was looking at this prospect list. And then today, Ian, you sent a link to us about Alex Reyes, who we drafted in the mock draft, and who is, spoiler alert, the number one prospect on this prospect list because he's got some arm problems and he's going for an MRI or something, and there's some doubt as to whether he will pitch this season, which is sad, of course.
Or he has had Tommy John surgery by the time you listen to this.
Yeah, that's true. Depends on how quickly I edit and post this. Yeah, so I wanted to talk at least briefly about the list as a resource, as one of the options for folks that don't know anything about prospects, which I would include myself in that group. And then, I guess, Ian, as much as you are interested in doing so, talk about the list itself and things that you like, and I guess maybe two things to keep in mind when you're looking at this list and thinking about score sheet, where, like, we would probably have, for example, Brendan Rodgers much higher than 11th just because he plays for the Rockies and he's a hitter, so that's cool. Things like that, but less obvious.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, if you haven't seen the list, I certainly recommend checking it out on baseballperspectus.com, but you probably have because you're here. Yeah, well, I think that's probably... I don't know if this is the most ominous prospect list ever, to lose your top prospect the day after you post the top 101. but, yeah, that's pretty much what 2017 feels like to me, so understandable. So when interpreting one of these lists for score sheet, it's an interesting task. I obviously, for a number of reasons, do not want to start like quibbling with the ranking of players on this list. This is fine, basically. You know, they work very hard. I saw, you know, all winter, like a ton of effort going to the list. They go out, they see players every day, they scout, they know more than I ever will. That said, they're looking for different things than we are as score sheet players. And I would say there are a couple of, I would say, generally useful heuristics that I would impart on the list. I think one of the things that these lists tend to overestimate in versus score sheet is ceiling and underestimate floor. I would look more towards high floor players. I think the top of the list is actually pretty relatively high floor guys in general. I think this list is actually pretty closer than usual, or closer than a number of other lists I've seen, to what would be kind of an optimal score sheet alignment. But, you know, even there, like, I would say Alex Reyes, who, as you know, we have gone on record as liking, even before today, should not have been the number one prospect. To be, again, to be perfectly candid, you know, I don't know that a pitching prospect should ever really be the number one prospect, unless it's a really unique circumstance, and this does not strike me as a really unique circumstance.
Like Matt Moore?
Yes. over Mike Trout, you mean?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, I like, you know, I can see it. Pitchers have to be drafted sometime. Pitchers are prospects, too. But, you know, I would much rather have a number of players below Lucas Giolito over Lucas Giolito. A number of players, you know, if would I trade Tyler Glass now for Gleyber Torres, who's a spot below him? Not really. You know, I think if you look at the top 20 players, I would kind of think move the shortstops up a little bit, move the pitchers down a little bit in general. Move the players who are closer to the majors up a little bit, move the players who are further away down a little bit. A-ball pitchers do not need to be drafted in most leagues. If you have a really competitive league, maybe, and you're out of it, go nuts. But I would rather miss on a few A-ball pitchers. There will always be pitchers who kind of pop up during the year, in my opinion.
All right.
Yeah, no problem.
Oh, sorry.
And no, I was hitting the cough button for a second.
I figured that pause was my cue.
Oh, no, I appreciate that, though. We're running a seamless enterprise here. The other thing I would say, again, like, you know, it's a little bit more true in score sheet that, you know, athleticism is reflected in the game a little bit. But I would probably look more towards performance players and less towards, I would say, high ceiling, again, like scouty players. Like, you may want to scout the stat line a little more than you would in real life. One, because I hate that phrase, and I prefer to, you know, like, you don't scout the stat line. You look at the stat line and you incorporate it, and you incorporate it correctly, which means giving it the proper weight. Okay, anyway, so you do that, and then you also, you know, maybe it is the pitcher who throws 89 to 91 and has a big strikeout history is better than the harder throwing pitcher above him. You know, I would have Jose De Leon well ahead of Amir Garrett, for example. I understand what Amir Garrett's potential is. I understand that Jose De Leon has a limited ceiling, but especially in the score sheet, which is a game that is based on statistical performance of players, I would like the player who has better statistical performance in the minor league and better projected statistical performance. That's me. Are there any players in particular who you're interested in?
No, I don't think so. Not,
I mean, okay.
Not personally.
One thing that I like about the page is that it has links to their rankings going back to 2007. And I think it's a little instructive to flip through those to get a sense of what these mean. You know, if you can look 3 or 4 years back and say, hey, if I had all the top 10 or all the top 20 players, you know, would that be good? Would that be bad? If I look at, you know, players 80 to 100, are any of them still in the majors? It's kind of interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Were you trying to find an Oriole?
You say that, but Bundy and Gausman both are super highly rated for a number of years. So.
Now, I stand corrected, obviously.
And there's one this year. That's all you need.
One all you need is a chance.
That's better than making a pun off his last name.
Because it involves a rapper?
Because I think we're just going to let that one sit there for a little while. as all of our listeners try to furiously come up with a pun based on his last name. Spreadsheet.facebookperspectives.com.
But we don't have any pictures of your thong.
Oh, no, Jared.
Is anyone you wanted to talk about specifically? Ian?
I would say not particularly. I think...
Ian proceeds to talk about specifically. Go ahead. No, it's fine.
No, I think, again, in general... you know, the shortstops are a little higher. I think you may want to... I would say... I'm tempted to say move some of the 2016 players up a little bit, or the 2016 draft class up a little bit. I kind of like them a little more than the list, but it doesn't matter because you probably overdrafted them in round 41 anyway, because that's what you do if you're in a score sheet. So that's probably academic. I will be very curious in the Robert Gazelman at number 17.
Is it pronounced Gazelman? I was trying to figure this one out.
Did you read Miller's story about him, Jared? Come on.
No.
Sorry. I read it. It says the scouting report says it's Gazelman. Like Gazelman.
Like you're on the Serengeti, and someone points over in the window, like, hey, look at the gazelle, man. As you sure. do.
Yeah.
I am curious. That's a player who has gotten some very strong love and some very, very, like, back-end or below disagreement. I know... Jeff Paternoster is very plugged into the New York Mets system, so I am inclined to look kindly upon that aggressive ranking, but I will be very interested to see it play out in real life. Beyond that, I think it all makes sense to me. Again, I would probably not have as many pitchers on that list, but I would probably have some grade 50 or below hitters who would not really excite anybody to see on a top 100 list. So this is probably better for business. that's about where I land.
Alright.
Oh, and I think this is a pretty... I do have actually one bigger point, which I probably should have led with. I think this is a relatively weak list. So, you know, look at, like, the 2015 list, and especially, like, by about slot 10 or so, you probably want to subtract, like, about 3 or 4 slots. Like, you know, I would say if you had the 25th pick a couple of years ago, you would be in better shape than the 25th pick this year, for instance, in general. So just factor that in. It's going to be a little bit harder to build through the minor leagues at the moment.
Unless you can keep 27 prospects.
Of course, unless you can keep 27
prospects. And draft 46 of the remainder.
Yeah. All right. The only other thing that I wanted to mention, I guess, before we wrap is the draft aid. I'll link to it in the little blurb that we put up on the website so that it's easy to find, but it's also linked all over the Baseball Prospectus website. So I guess with mostly through Rob's help, Rob McCune, put together a metric that's meant to measure score sheet value roughly in terms of runs. It's not really perfectly runs-based, but it's roughly runs-based. It's called SSim, and Rob put together a tool that lets you pull up your league and see who the players are that are available in your league that have the highest projected SSim for the upcoming season, which is a pretty handy way to sort of build a short list of guys that you might be interested in, especially maybe later in the draft when you're looking to fill out your back end of your roster and you don't really know who the studs are, or if you're looking for ideas, guys that might have been overlooked. It's even got a thing where he shows the top-ranked prospects that are still available in your league. So if you're looking to build for the future, there's that too. I think, especially because historically we've done a giant ranking list, and this year we're not, I wanted to make sure that we pointed out that there are tools out there that you can use to get sort of a proxy of what the value would look like in terms of draft position. I think the mock draft is one of those, and the score sheets and projections for the coming year are sort of another one. Realize that, I guess, maybe this is obvious, maybe it's not. The score sheets and projection is just for 2017. So if you're looking for like long-term value, it's not quite as relevant. And probably the mock draft is a little bit better representation because it's meant to be the initial draft for a continuing league that's meant to go in perpetuity. So if you're looking at keeper sorts of decisions, the mock draft is probably a little bit better generally, just because it's going to help you value the future a little bit more correctly, I guess, for lack of a better word. So.
Yeah, I think this is, if you're a score sheet player, this is really one of the, like, it's a killer reason to subscribe to Baseball Prospectus. You know, it's an app that gives you information you won't find anywhere else. And that's not us saying it because we're presented by them. It's something that we would use anyway, no matter what. One of us built it or helped. So, you know, I certainly feel strongly about it. I would also say, even more than sorting on SSM, it's a great way of quickly eyeballing what's left in your league and sorting it by handedness, which I do all the time, and then by defensive ratings, which I do all the time, and error ratings. I look at those pretty strongly during the draft as I'm going. So, highly recommend that you do too if you haven't checked it out yet.
Yeah, and Rob did a great job building the interface, so it's real handy to sort of click to sort through those columns and get a nice list sorted by whatever you want.
So. But it has Mike Trout rated first, so how accurate can it be?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Is that all we got?
Think so.
We talked like almost exclusively score sheet stuff.
Well, there's still time to change that.
All right. Well, in that case, Ben, what's the best thing you saw this week?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't think I have. I don't know. I don't have anything good. I hadn't thought about it, to be honest.
Okay, no problem.
Yeah.
The best thing he saw this week is our lovely faces.
That's Jared? Not right, no.
Do you have the best thing you saw this week?
I got one story real quick. I was at Disney World this past week.
And, I'm gonna hold yours for the end because I think I know where this is going. No. Is it where you told me?
No, it was going to be something else, but that's a good one too.
Okay, I'm going to hold you to the end because yours is going to be better. I can already tell. I was at Disney World means we're closing with that. Just little programmed out for you. Anyway, so mine isn't that great, although it is great. The best thing I saw this week, I went back and watched the pilot of Friday Night Lights for the first time in 12 years.
Man, I keep telling myself I want to do a rewatch of that.
Don't you have better things to do with your time?
Not than Friday Night Lights. No one has better things to do with their time than Friday Night Lights. Are you kidding me?
I mean, it depends on how you value your time, sure. But, it's probably better for the first minute and then just tapers off after the next 50. Anyway, it was something that, I had a few friends who were kind of saying what to watch. I realized, it came up. They had not watched Friday Night Lights. We had the "Is it really about football?" conversation, which is always a charm. And, I hadn't seen it in such a long time. It had been, I think, almost 5 years since I had seen an episode. I had seen one episode last year under extremely extenuating circumstances. Which is that we were in Dillon, Texas. But other than that, it had been a very long time since I saw the series fresh. And I definitely wondered whether it was going to hold up. I don't think Friday Night Lights is the best television show of all time. When it comes down to it, I think it was a little too inconsistent in places, and had a very rocky season that we will never talk about.
Shut up.
I do think Friday Night Lights had the best opening episode of all time. Ooh. And I was struck by, even though, not every character was exactly the right tone that they would have for the rest of the series, even though there was a little bit of, explaining, okay, hello you, the fullback, it was kept to a minimum, and it was so gripping and vivid, and even the parts that were, could be seen as schmaltzy, were completely upended by the end of the opening episode, which I don't want to spoil, which is weird because it's a 12-year-old show and you probably literally know the premise. It's the first episode. But by some chance you haven't seen it recently or you haven't seen it at all, go back and watch how fully formed the town of Dillon feels immediately. I have long said that, Friday Night Lights and The Wire, they don't share a background very much, but they, just in terms of the staging and presentation, they definitely feel like parallel path shows, two different ways of looking at life. And, there's something very appealing about The Wire's sense of institutions as a failure and the deep cynicism that anything can ever be fixed, which... may have some resonance in 2017, but there's also Friday Night Lights optimism that people have. That I think Friday Night Lights is no less cynical about institutions than The Wire is when it comes down to it, but it has a belief that people have the ability to impact other people's lives and for the better. If they, with care, with time, and with effort. I actually do believe that that is, in a way, more real than what The Wire offered. I think they compare and contrast very well, and, I also, I also think Landry is immediately funny. Like, so, yeah. And, you know, some of the show is just immediately gripping and actually earnest and amusing. And they just have the tone right from jump. The shaky cam has never, ever bothered me, not even for a second. But I hear that it affects some people. So if that's you, just, I don't know, get over it or something. Sorry, it'll taper off in the next two episodes or so. But I always liked it. And the parts that are great remain great. The football play is ridiculous, but we just watched that Super Bowl, so maybe I can't judge football any more than I can judge reality here in 2017. Welcome to America. Watch Friday Night Lights. Jared, any other thoughts? Do you think Friday Night Lights had the best pilot ever?
That's a tough call. I'd have to go through it. It's got to be up there, I think. Yeah, it's really strong.
Yeah, I was thinking Friday Night Lights. I thought The Sopranos had an incredibly strong pilot, and I'm not quite as high on the series as most. I think pilot alone rules out pretty much every comedy. Because I think comedies tend to take a little bit more time to gel. I've heard maybe Firefly. I haven't seen that. I thought maybe Veronica Mars for a second. But I don't know. For my money, I'd go with this, even after some further reflection. So if you want an hour of time, watch or rewatch this great American show.
Yeah, two thumbs up. There's probably some older pilots that we should be considering, but...
Yeah, go watch Gunsmoke next. Okay, Jared, what's the next thing you saw this week?
All right, I'll just cut it down to the one story, the one I told you. So I was at Disney World this past week with my family, and because I was with my family, I needed to find a drink at Disney World. This was the fourth day of our five-day trip. We were at Hollywood Studios.
Now, by the way, I know that Disney has, like, adult areas, but... I can't help but think, like, you're sitting there and, like, Mickey is next to you and we're like, same, buddy. Just having a really hard time picturing adult at Disneyland. Okay, go ahead.
And so we were at Hollywood Studios and we had, like, a little bit of time to kill. And so we went to the Tune-In Lounge, which is actually relatively hidden for a Disney place. It's sort of connected to one of the... diner type places at Hollywood Studios, but the sign isn't really outward facing, so you just sort of this door. It's not like quite speakeasy-ish, but for Disney World, it was a little hard to find. And so we go in there, and obviously I'm wearing an Orioles hat because I'm an Orioles fan. Well, it was funny because we saw, like, over the course of the trip, we saw three or four other people wearing Orioles hats. And, like, the rest of my family was like, you know, is there some, like, secret handshake you guys have? Shouldn't you be like, yeah, go O's? And I was like, no, like, O's fans, we're more subtle than that. Just, like, a little head nod is all you need to, like, acknowledge, like, there's another Orioles fan in existence in the world outside of the Baltimore area. But, so we go to this place to get a drink that also sells for an extra $3. There's a light-up ice cube thingy that goes in, so your drink sparkles and has all sorts of colors because Disney World. Anyway, so we get our drinks, and the bartender lady is like, oh, is that an Orioles hat? And I was like, well, yes, it is. She's like, are you an Orioles fan? I was like, yep, I am. And she's like, my nephew pitches for the Orioles. He's in the minor leagues. And I was like, oh, I know some Orioles minor leaguers. You know, who is your nephew? And her nephew is Tanner Scott. If you are not an Orioles fan, you probably don't know that Tanner Scott is one of the Orioles prospects. They do have them. If you Google Tanner Scott, the fourth thing headline that comes up is Orioles prospect Tanner Scott pitching well, comma, has become valuable. So he's got that going for him.
The byline is Danger Cat.
That's pretty much the end of the story. We just talked briefly about Tanner Scott because there's not that much to talk about Tanner Scott, really. But it was kind of cool to go to Disney World and meet Tanner Scott's aunt.
Yeah, so I have a number of thoughts here. You know, first of all, congratulations on managing to work the Orioles into a place where they have just no business being.
The happiest place on earth?
Yeah. Second, what was your reaction when his aunt said, I am related to an Orioles minor leaguer? Because, well, she didn't say prospect, right? My son is a prospect. Because, you know, you're getting into pretty dicey territory pretty quickly there.
Yeah,
like, I mean, I'm not expecting them all to be John Sickles. Like you don't have to have a realistic position on your nephew. Like, he can be a great prospect, but boy, you know, after about 10 names or so, you know, it's a guy who's really enjoying his summer in Bowie.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Like, there's so many minor leaguers in any system. The odds of knowing one is, if you meet a relative, is pretty small, even if you are a prospect hound.
So, yeah, and now you have a new favorite Orioles prospect, I feel like, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I look forward to him leading the Cubs to the World Series in a few years.
Well, the O's, if you didn't see, have an opening in their rotation to start the season, so their opening day starter is not going to be starting opening day.
Oh, I missed this. This
Chris Tillman is 3 weeks behind schedule, so that's going to be fun.
Is that due to injury or is he just? Did he just knock that out? Did he try to send him like an Outlook invite, and he was like,
he didn't show up. He called in sick for the first week and a half.
Yeah.
No, he received a platelet-rich plasma injection in December that apparently nobody knew about, and he's 3 weeks behind schedule for that. The best that Orioles news, though, is they signed Juan Francisco to a minor league contract. And if you go to RotoWorld, the first sentence of the description of Juan Francisco is, Francisco did not play anywhere professionally in 2016. And I was like, yeah, that's an Orioles signing right there.
Well, you know, Tomo Welker needs someone to strike out. Anyway, on that note, it's a little late here. We're all a little punchy. Thank you again for bearing with us. Any questions that you might have, send to scoresheet@baseballperspectives.com. Look forward to hearing from you. Anything else, or should we call it a day?
I'm good.
Okay. Thanks again. On behalf of Ben Murphy and Jared Weiss, I'm Ian Lefkowitz. Thanks again, and have a great day.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.